Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A federal judge in Texas last week ruled the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional because the law no longer includes an individual mandate to participate. Political health care reporter Alice Miranda Olstein has been covering the news. She joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Alice, how did the Texas judge arrive at this decision?
So the Texas judge agreed with the group of Republican attorneys general who brought the case, who argued that because Congress voted to repeal the individual mandate penalty, what you have to pay if you don't get insurance, and that will go away next year. And because that's going away next year, the judge and the Republican attorneys general said the entire rest of the law has to go as well, because when Congress originally created the Affordable Care Act, it was created as a package deal, and you can't sever one part from the other. The blue states defending the Affordable Care Act said that Congress clearly intended just to get rid of that one little piece of it and not the entire thing, because they had plenty of opportunities to get rid of the entire thing and could never muster the votes to do so.
It's being disputed, too, whether or not it's automatic that when you get rid of one piece of a law, the rest of the law falls.
Yes, exactly. And I think we saw that earlier in earlier challenges to the Affordable Care Act that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. There was this question of severability. And there was even question on the other side, because when Obamacare was created, it's true that it was created to be this package deal. And that was part of getting the insurers on board with the entire thing, is that they said, look, you have to cover everyone, no matter how sick they are or how expensive their care is, but in return, we'll have this mandate that encourages younger, healthier people to buy insurance as well, to even things out in the risk pool.
We are talking about the Texas federal judge's ruling last week that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional because the Congress removed the individual mandate from the law last year. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Alice Miranda Olstein. She is a political health care reporter, has been covering this topic. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, if you go by his tweets, the president is thrilled about this, right?
If you go by the tweets, if you go by what the administration is formally saying, they're formally saying that the law remains in effect, Obamacare remains in effect. They will continue to administer it as they did before the ruling came down. And there is a lot of concern about this, both from the administration and among Republicans in Congress, because this could take a long time to make its way up through the federal courts, potentially all the way to the Supreme Court. And the last thing the Trump administration and Republicans want is, on the eve of the 2020 election, to have tens of millions of people afraid of losing their health insurance.
It's not clear ultimately what is going to be ruled in this case. It's got to go up, as you said, it's got to go up a food chain of courts first, right?
Yes, exactly. And so the next stop, potentially, is the Fifth Circuit. And while many legal experts say this case is extremely weak, they just got this one very ideological judge on their side, but these arguments likely will not fly, even with higher courts that are dominated by conservatives. But you just never know. We've seen crazier things happen with lawsuits related to health care.
And Congress, it's unclear what they're going to do in the Senate. We know the Senate Democrats are calling, though, for a vote on to intervene in the case.
That's true. So Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, he called on Sunday for the Senate to vote to say, look, we intend the rest of the Affordable Care Act to stay even without the mandate. And that is not likely to happen in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. That vote is not likely to happen. I've been talking to Republican senators who have been throwing cold water on the idea and saying we shouldn't be telling the courts what to do, although Congress has voted in the past to intervene in lawsuits related to federal laws before, several times before. But in the House next year, when Democrats will have a strong majority, they plan to vote to intervene in the lawsuit right away. And that could have both a political and a practical impact. Politically, it allows Democrats to say, look, we're out there fighting to defend protections for pre-existing conditions and everything else. And practically, they could argue, that the intent of Congress was that the rest of the Affordable Care Act should remain in place without the mandate.
What is the Trump administration's obligation, if any, to defend the law?
Well, they made that choice. They made that choice months ago. They decided to side with the Republican attorneys general attacking the law in part. They didn't side with them entirely, but they decided not to defend the Affordable Care Act, a federal law still on the books, which was an unusual but not totally unprecedented choice.
And so it was left to a group of Democratic attorneys general to defend the law in Texas, right?
Yes, led by California. And last night they filed the sort of first step in challenging this ruling, asking the judge to clarify if he's going to stay the impact of the ruling and put it off until it works its way through the appeals, or allow an immediate appeal to the Fifth Circuit. Right now, it's completely in limbo. Mm.
And Democrats retake control of the House in January, as we said. They are going to, they've already said that they will vote. But what are they going to do? They will intervene, or are they going to have a vote to intervene?
Yes. So they don't have to have a vote to intervene, but my sources tell me they would like to do so in order to put the Republicans who campaigned on protecting pre-existing conditions in a tough spot.
It makes them go on the record protecting it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Right.
And even though they could just direct the House counsel to do so without a formal vote.
You already mentioned the timing of this. It could take all the way into the eve of the 2020 presidential election / congressional reelection.
Yes.
I mean, the whole thing, it'll be could be a very big cluster. But this was the big bone of contention. It wasn't the economy, stupid. In 2018 midterms, it was the healthcare, stupid.
Well, absolutely. And it was such a dramatic reversal from what we saw even just a few years ago. And it just really shows that people fear change, especially when it comes to something as personal and as impactful as healthcare. In 2010, voters punished Democrats for shaking up the healthcare system and passing the Affordable Care Act. And in 2018, they punished Republicans for attempting to wind that back and take those things away.
Do we know, maybe this is looking too fast forward by 10 to do, what kind of seats are up for grabs in the Senate in 2020?
Well, both Republicans and Democrats will be defending seats.
Yeah.
It will be it'll be a difficult map for Democrats to take back the Senate, especially because of the Republican gains this past election. But it won't be as much of an uphill battle as this past election. It's just hard. And I think there was a lot of scrutiny in this past election on the Senate itself as an institution where states, as the certain states grow massively in population, people are really questioning, does the Senate represent the country? And you see that sort of imbalance there, whereas more and more of the country, millions of people, are not having the same representation as very conservative rural states with very few people. Obviously, that's why we have the House, but it's at least worth debating.
The president also, besides cheering on this ruling, said that now they can go back and remake the law, make it bigger and better, or something to that effect. What's the likelihood of something like that happening?
Almost none. I mean, it's the same line we've been hearing for years and years and years from the Republican House for years and from President Trump during the campaign until now. They've always said, we're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better. What that something better was, they were never able to agree on. They never had the votes for a replacement plan. They only agreed on repeal. And now that option is closed to them through Congress. And so they went to the courts.
What about the strength of the law as it stood even before the Texas ruling? Because without that individual mandate, it does turn it into kind of a two-legged bench. I mean, the individual mandate is part of what props up the finances, the equation of ACA.
Yes, although the loss of the mandate didn't cause the humongous drop-off in enrollment that was originally predicted. Part of that is because a lot of experts thought the mandate was never strong enough in the first place. The penalty they thought was too small to really force people to buy insurance, mm-hmm. and the exceptions were very wide. A lot of people could claim exemptions from the mandate for different reasons. And so the mandate was never the tough stick people thought. But what was very influential and continues to survive without the mandate is the carrot, which are the subsidies. So a lot of people, the majority of people in the individual market, can get a subsidized plan. They're protected from these price increases, these premium increases we hear so much about. And that has really encouraged a lot of people to sign up. And so that's why I think you're seeing markets with lots of enrollees, less than last year, but still enough to keep it going.
Yeah, about a 10% drop off from last year, right?
Well, we're waiting for the final numbers. Okay. And so up until last week. So the final numbers will come out probably tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that's important because everyone procrastinates and it's human nature to wait for the final few days to sign up. So we could really see either whether we see a surge at the end or whether maybe the judge's ruling in Texas put fear into people and discourage them from signing up because they mm-hmm. thought the law might not be in place.
Yeah. What about the timing all of that? Is anyone talking about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it seems almost the judge, we've been waiting for this ruling for weeks and weeks, thinking mm-hmm. it could come out any day. And it came out on the eve of the final day of open enrollment, which almost seemed designed for maximal chaos and confusion.
The Democrats, am I right that they've been talking about going forward with improvements to the law in the meantime?
Yes. In the House, there mm-hmm. is talk of bringing up a stabilization bill, which would do a lot of things. It's not exactly clear which provisions, but there's a lot of interest in restoring the budget for outreach to tell people about open enrollment and encourage them to sign up. The Trump administration slashed that budget by 90%, which many experts say is leading to some of the drop-off we're seeing. People just don't know what's going on. In fact, the Kaiser Family Foundation had a poll recently showing that more than 75% of people did not know the correct deadline for open enrollment this year. So that's definitely troubling to a lot of folks in Congress. So there's interest in restoring some of that outreach funding, the funding for the navigators who help people enroll, even thinking about extending the deadline for open enrollment, but also looking at ways to prop up the markets, maybe make subsidies more generous, mm-hmm. maybe introduce some sort of federal reinsurance program. There's a lot of debate about that right now.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, I read an MSNBC this morning, or was it Monday, yesterday, that healthcare stocks plunged after the ruling in Texas. Not just healthcare, but I guess hospitals and healthcare providers in general are destabilized by this. How so?
Well, the people think of the Affordable Care Act and they think, oh, well, this won't affect me because I'm not, quote unquote, on Obamacare. And what people normally mean by that is I'm not enrolled in the Medicaid exchange and I'm not enrolled in the individual market. And yes, those are the people who would be most impacted by the loss of the Affordable Care Act if it really truly went away. But there's just so much of this law that's embedded in every single piece of our healthcare system. A lot of it behind the scenes, something a regular patient would never see. So, you know, hospital payment rates, prescription drug price controls. If you're on your employer insurance, that could be because of the employer mandate. If you're on Medicare, there's provisions that affect you. So it's a piece of every single part of our system, both public and private insurance. And something this sweeping, a ruling this sweeping, could really cause havoc in all pieces. And I think that's why you're seeing the Trump administration, even as it says that Obamacare is bad and should fall and they should replace it with something better, you are seeing HHS move to reassure all of the different stakeholders that there will be no changes right now and they will continue to sail forward as smoothly as possible until we know more.
And just one more question before I let you go, Alice, and that is there was a rallying cry, Medicare for All, in more of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party for sure. Mm-hmm. Does this give any traction to that?
It definitely could. So there's definitely thinking that, you know, passing the Affordable Care Act, which was a compromise, which was a an idea that was conservative in its origins. It came out of conservative think tanks, and it was pioneered in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney. It was essentially a private market plan. And there are folks who say, look, if we're going to have years and years of political and court battles for this compromise legislation that covered a lot more people, tens of millions more people, but not everybody, it left, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people are left uninsured, we should use this as fuel to push for some sort of universal coverage system. And so you're definitely hearing those arguments here in Congress. Mm.
Alice Miranda Olstein, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Alice Miranda Olstein is a political healthcare reporter. We are going to try to touch base with some of the stakeholders going forward in this issue. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A federal judge in Texas last week ruled the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional because the law no longer includes an individual mandate to participate. If upheld, the ruling would throw out the health care law's pre-existing condition protections, premium subsidies, and much more. That includes expanded Medicaid, which has brought health care coverage to millions of low-income households, including nearly 700,000 people in Ohio. We're talking about what the ruling means for Ohio and the nation. Joining us is Executive Director of the Universal Health Care Action Network of Ohio, which supports the ACA, Steve Wagner. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And also, welcome back to Hederman, Executive Director of the Economic Research Center and Vice President of Policy at the Buckeye Institute, a conservative think tank. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I asked you guys off air, and I'll just do it again. Steve Wagner, what's your best guess about what's going to happen?
Well, I think the important thing to know is nothing's going to happen anytime soon. Okay, so no changes that are happening to anybody's coverage for quite a long time, unless the judge for some reason decides that this needs to be imposed today, in which case that will allow them to go to appeals court and ask
immediately. Yeah. In the long run?
In the long run, again, that is going to be the long run. It's probably not going to be decided in 2019, probably not till 2020 that the circuit court would issue a decision. And at that point in time, they could say the judge is completely wrong and throw the whole thing out. They could take parts and pieces to say, yes, this should be ruled unconstitutional, but the rest should stand.
Mm. Ray Hederman.
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see efforts by the appeals court, and I'll definitely go to the Supreme Court with the split between the states. I mean, this is something that you had 20 Republican states basically signing up suing, and then you've had a large number of Democrat
Almost
attorney governors
many, yeah.
exactly saying on the other side. So this seems something that will make its way to the Supreme Court, and it'll be the third time a major constitutional challenge to the Affordable Care Act has made it to the Supreme Court. And I think, as Steve said so wisely, you know, the first thing everybody should remember is don't panic. I think, you know, people are not going to lose their Medicaid coverage, insurance coverage anytime soon. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that the administration has made, through Health and Human Services, Secretary Azar, the named defendant, has promised that the ACA remains, you know, in effect. Nothing is going to change, and they remain committed to carrying out the law that's on the books. And so, you know, we've got about a year or two to think about it. But at the same time, this is a serious challenge to pieces of the Affordable Care Act. The condition, pre-existing conditions, community rating, guaranteed issue, the provisions that directly apply to the insurance markets, Title I, could be in great danger.
I've always seen the Affordable Care Act is an organic whole, that when you do start to peck away at bits and pieces of it, well, especially like the individual mandate, that it becomes a two-legged instead of a three-legged stool and can't sustain. Now, you know, the reporter from the Politico said, well, that's true, except the individual mandate penalty wasn't enough to make that much of a difference, and that they didn't see as much fall off as they expected to when they eliminated the individual mandate, that they found that the law is more popular than they expected. So what does it mean, Steve? Right, I mean, so, how much can you pack away at this?
Yeah, so you could easily say that the mandate itself didn't even impact what Ray was referring to, which was the individual insurance market. And so that's the argument there, that it wasn't even as critical there. And so when you start to go farther and you say, well, did this impact Medicaid? Well, it really seems like a stretch to say that the individual mandate had an impact on Medicaid and the expansion. Mm.
Yeah, you know, and the Affordable Care Act is just a huge mammoth piece of legislation that fundamentally changed the healthcare market. I mean, if you think about it, you know, not just Medicaid expansion, Steve mentioned, but the rules regarding, you know, innovations in Medicare, pharmaceutical drugs, biosimilars. I mean, everything to menus and restaurants, you know, were all wrapped into this piece of legislation.
That's right.
And the judge said, now this is all gone. So you could definitely see a Supreme Court. And one of the things is, you know, Justice Roberts, who, you know, upheld, obviously, in NFIB versus Abilius, he's a jurist known for basically trying to keep decisions narrow and not striking everything. So one path would be the Supreme Court says, you know what, maybe we'll keep everything in the law. The mandate penalties, you know, it's just gone. Or they could sit there and say, we're going to make sure pre-existing conditions is gone as well. But I think most people would anticipate that it would be very much out of character for the record of the Supreme Court to say, everything's gone, go back and start over. And that may mean striking down Medicaid expansion, you know, drug reforms, along with the insurance protections.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. In the wake of the federal judge ruling in Texas, he struck down the entire Affordable Care Act. Of course, this is going to be appealed. It could be a couple years. It doesn't change coverage right now. And we're talking about the prospects going forward. You just heard from Ray Hederman. He's executive director of the Economic Research Center and vice president of policy at the Buckeye Institute. And also with us, Steve Wagner, executive director of Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Before we go to some calls, I want to ask you guys what if how the law has been rolled out over the years and how it's been managed, if you've learned anything about the policy that's changed your mind about it, or if you would, you know, what your takeaway at this point is, Steve Wagner, from this huge law that affects so many things now. Does it work? Does it not work? I mean,
yeah, so to think of it as a single issue is, I think, what we're struggling with here anyway,
yeah.
Right? And the ACA is like a big car. When we talk about what got removed, somebody said that you can't have a seatbelt in the back, and now they're trying to say you can't drive your car because you're missing a seatbelt. So to say, what have we learned about the ACA and what's important, I think it is that people become accustomed to things, right? We've seen the viewpoint politically change very much in terms of the people, right? It's now a majority of people are favorable to the ACA, a majority are favorable to Medicaid. They become accustomed to these, they realize it, but they don't always equate it with the ACA, right? They don't think, oh, that pre-existing conditions, the 26.
They just know they're getting the services
yeah, that's
that
right.
they want and need and that kind of a thing,
right.
And they aren't as analytical about it as maybe we're being right now. What about you, Ray Hederman? I mean, the Buckeye Institute was not pro-ACA in the beginning and never has been particularly, but I've found you over the years becoming much more analytical about it and more, you know, it's in the details.
Sure. I think, you know, there are a couple of lessons that I see. And I think the first thing is, has Republicans learned to the great sorrow in 2017, is that People are afraid of uncertainty, particularly when it comes to dealing with health issues. If you can't provide a roadmap making sure that people feel comfortable about the plan, you're going to see massive resistance. And the Republican effort failed so miserably on that front that it, you know, boosted the Affordable Care Act to unprecedented levels of popularity. You know, Steve noticed more people now in favor of it.
When because, they were threatened with
losing exactly,
it.
Okay. Because people are afraid of losing access to their doctor and their coverage. They've already gone through this one time. And they're afraid about the alternative plans. I think the second thing is that taking a look in that, there was a lot of need that needed to be addressed. And so I think, you know, Republicans and conservatives need to take a look and say, how are you going to make sure people have access to care? I think the ACA remains the wrong vehicle, but it's important to realize that, you know, there is a need for people to be able to get better access to care than existed before the ACA. So taking lessons, improving on that, figuring out the next path. And finally, I let me just point out that I think the Azar decision really puts the pressure on Republicans, because a lot of Republicans ran in the past year saying, we're going to protect pre-existing conditions. You know, we are a party. We're going to make sure that we've learned our lesson. We're going to make sure that we extend these protections to people. And now, sooner than they think, from November, they're going to have to, you know, basically be held accountable for statements saying that we had a good way to protect patients.
Yeah, the ACA is a vehicle that doesn't work for everyone. And it has its problems.
Like, every time we get together, we get a call from somebody saying, I can't afford it.
Right. Yeah. Or you can afford insurance, but, you know, your deductible is so high that, you know, you can't ever use
it. It's not practical.
So, and that's why the individual mandate was so unpopular and remains unpopular, because you had people saying, I had to pay a penalty or buy a product that was expensive if you weren't getting a subsidy, you know, that you couldn't really use. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's, I think, a lot of things we have to address in terms of value. And that's what maybe one of the things I'm most sorry about in terms of the dialogue we've had for 2 years now, which is we had to argue about whether people were going to be covered or not. We didn't start really talking about how we're going to lower costs on pharmaceuticals or other aspects of the healthcare system to provide people value. Instead, we were arguing whether we were going to cover 20 million people.
About the larger moral, I don't know if it's a moral question. For some people it is. For other people it's a practical question. Is healthcare a right? Is it something people should expect?
I think it's something that, I wouldn't even go to a right. I think if we really want to have a functioning economy, we need to figure out how to make sure people are healthy and can work. We need to do that in a cost-effective way.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You know, I think that's very well put by Steve, saying, you know, as a society, we've determined that we're going to take care of people that are vulnerable and needy, right? You know, hospitals,
by law. We did that a long time ago.
Right. By law, you know, hospitals cannot turn away somebody who's having a heart attack. The debate we're having in this country is basically, what is the right way to kind of deliver the care? And what do you mean by having access to every care? Does that mean you have access to every procedure? You know, does that mean that you have access to a replacement knee? You know, every society on earth is kind of wrestling with those questions mm-hmm. right now. But that's kind of the basic idea. And I think the idea is, how do we provide affordable care without creating a lot of disincentives and keeping healthcare innovation going, because everybody wants access to new formulas and new medicines?
Dan in Pleasantville, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
I appreciate all the effort going to discuss and try to fix the health care, that, you know, the Obamacare and so forth. But all of that stuff is kind of a waste, as long as we don't try to address some of the reasons why healthcare itself, in the first place, is so expensive. That if you drive around and you look where there are hospital versions of hospitals, all kinds of care units, everything being constantly built all the time, and then they are very elaborate. Hospitals are very, very elaborate, with $20 million of facades and all kinds of things that aren't necessarily necessary. They just make people feel warm and fuzzy when they go in there. And it makes contractors, people that do not provide health care, very wealthy. Now, that provides jobs, and that's good. But there has to be some, if pole barns are one of the most efficient things in the world you can build to house something.
Hmm. I see what he's saying. I went to a doctor in Ireland a few years ago, and it was linoleum floors and folding chairs, and she was excellent. But it wasn't fancy. It was just basic, and that, of course, they have healthcare for all there.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, part of what I think the caller is getting at is that we have seen an expansion and consolidation of hospitals, right, where hospitals have been acquiring independent doctors' practices, and as a result, prices increase. And so we've seen some movement trying to say, look, let's go back, let's figure out kind of alternatives to putting everybody in hospital beds that are more affordable so people can go to, you know, urgent care centers, but you pay them smaller prices than hospitals, right, because it should be cheaper there.
They don't have the infrastructure.
Exactly.
Right?
And so we've seen the administration trying to move to something called site-neutral payment reform, which I think is a strong innovation. And the idea is, let's innovate, take advantage of basically services provided by different care providers, by nurses, doctors, in alternative settings than a monolithic hospital.
Yeah. We've got to figure out how to, whether it's decrease all these administrative costs, when we think of oftentimes people hold up Medicare as being a good system. Well, Medicaid is the same way. It has a very low amount that goes to administrative overhead as opposed to private insurance. Mm-hmm. We've got very high administrative overhead going to pharmaceutical companies. So we have a lot of expenditures in this system, which is very fragmented, that do not improve our care. And how do we reduce those?
Nora in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nora.
Hi. I totally agree with that caller in that there's nothing wrong with linoleum floors and decent chairs to sit on. We don't need fireplaces and grand pianos in our hospitals. My thought is we do need Medicare.
I'm losing you, Nora.
Okay. Everybody says it's impossible, hear me, to have Medicare for all. My idea is, why not have all, and this is just in our state, the rest of the country can work it out, but why don't the churches and synagogues and mosques pay property taxes on all the land they own, like all the rest of us do? And that money could be earmarked to go to the state to pay to put everyone on Medicare.
Okay. Nora, thanks for your call.
I think there's a lot of different funding models that we could come up with about how we would start to address making sure that everyone has health care coverage. Certainly, some of it might be taxes on entities, organizations, larger businesses. Tobacco tax is something that would both improve our public health, because it would reduce tobacco use and it would provide some level of funding. There are ways to think about funding this along with, by decreasing some of that, whether you want to call it waste or inefficiency in the system, that we could start to get to covering more people.
So you're starting to see some states try to experiment now with basically some type of version of a single-payer Medicare for all type system, right? And so the problem, you've had three states, Vermont, Colorado, and California, that have attempted to enact a single-payer at the state level. But they've all stopped when they've actually seen the price tag, because the price tag in terms of what it would do, like basically doubling your tax collections at the state level. And so it'll be interesting to see, I think, where California goes, where Governor Newsom basically ran on saying, I'm going to try to enact a single payer. And I think, you know, again, you know, once people start seeing the price tag, trying to figure out how to do it, the tax increases there, they get very worried about it. And let me disagree with Steve a little bit that administration savings are not as big as they seem, because private companies pay more in administrative savings because they invest more in anti-fraud detection. So, you know, if the idea is saying making sure that payments are actually done for procedures that are delivered, has compared to Medicare and Medicaid. So Medicare and Medicaid have more fraud in them through, you know, has Senator Menendez.
Because they have less anti-fraud.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And everything in there. So it's a trade-off. And so, you know, you're not going to get a magic bullet of, you know, whacking out administrative costs, because unfortunately that could increase the incentive for bad actors.
Let's take a break. Then we're going to hear from the Ohio Hospital Association and what they think about this latest ruling and the prospects going forward for the Affordable Care Act in the United States. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A federal judge in Texas last week ruled the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. The ruling is expected to be appealed to the Supreme Court, and the final outcome is likely more than a year away, probably closer to 2 years away. But hospital and health insurer stocks took a hit on Monday, right after the ruling. Still with us is Executive Director of Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, Steve Wagner. Also, Ray Hederman, Executive Director of the Economic Research Center and Vice President of Policy at the Buckeye Institute. Joining us by phone is Director of Media and Public Relations for the Ohio Hospital Association, John Palmer. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
What's the short-term concern for the healthcare industry in the wake of the Texas ruling?
Well, Ann, this is something that is not pleasant news, especially when you're talking about just pulling a major healthcare law like the Affordable Care Act without a replacement. And so, you know, a little different than the discussions and activity that happened in Congress in 2017 when there was attempts to repeal and replace. In this particular situation, it's setting the stage for a repeal without a replacement. And that's very concerning for hospitals in Ohio and a lot of our counterparts around the state and other areas of providing health care, especially around the Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. Ohio's made a lot of great progress in the implementation of Medicaid expansion. It's just something that we didn't take from the feds. We kind of made it our own here in Ohio and how that was managed and overseen. So, Ohio's done, I think, from that standpoint, careful kind of deliberations on the management of that. But to get the news from Friday and where it's going to be going in this legal process does have us concerned.
How do you plan for the future?
That's one of the big things. Hospitals are organizations that are, forecasting and making plans for their facilities to meet the healthcare needs of their communities. And, when you get situations like this, oftentimes with government and reimbursements and coverage changes, it is hard to accurately forecast and predict, because if you are accounting for a certain population to have healthcare coverage, to just find out that there's the potential that they won't have healthcare coverage, that does impact operations a little bit. But where it stands today, the ACA is alive and well, and we're going to proceed accordingly. But you do have that on the horizon that we're definitely going to be mindful of moving forward.
I want to get to a couple calls right now. We've been talking, John Palmer, maybe you were listening, just about the cost of healthcare, just the bottom line to people. Why is it so expensive? Some people were talking about kind of the frills that they see as frills, the pianos in the lobbies of the hospitals, that kind of a thing. Leslie in Mount Victory in Ohio here wanted to address that. Hi, Leslie, you're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to say that I had to take my husband up to Cleveland recently, and they have some of those frills in the hospital, mm-hmm. but I see a lot of those things being paid for by big money donations. But the outcome of that, what I see, it helped me, and I think it helps him too, is it helps the healing process. You know, when you've been driving past areas in the city that look run down, and, you know, we grew up in the country, but to get to a hospital that feels comfortable, that has these things that make you feel, it just helps mm-hmm. with your health overall, to feel better.
Yeah, and
so it's not waste. I get the other people's comments about some of the frills, but it's not always a waste. It helps your emotional stability when you're trying to heal from a surgery or from whatever you've got going on.
Leslie, thank you so much for that call. I mean, you know, John Palmer, I think she makes a really interesting point about how healthcare is complicated and wellness is not just a matter of getting the right pill and getting the right diagnosis.
Yeah, it really ties into a lot with overall wellness and just from you know, recovery standpoint, and you know, hospitals doing a lot more partnerships with organizations and engaging more with patients and their families, knowing that it's taking more of a collective type of approach to help with the healing and recovering process going on. And, you know, here in Ohio, we have about a little over 230 hospitals, and, you know, they're all across the state. But this year alone, in 2018, we had 3 hospitals close in Ohio. Mm. And what we're experiencing is about 42 hospitals, roughly, through our analysis, have negative operating margins. So, you know, it is something that we're concerned about, is the ability for access in these communities, because with the Affordable Care Act, and now you have hundreds of thousands of Ohioans now with an insurance card able to go out and get access to healthcare, preventative services. Yeah, as healthcare and hospitals, we're trying to meet that new demand through access, and we're committed to making sure that we have the appropriate resources available to meet those specific community needs across the state. So, you know, that's something we're going to continue to focus on moving forward.
Hmm. Yeah, Ray Hederman?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important to note that, I mean, depending on where you are, what city you are, right, you'll see a lot more expansion for hospitals. I mean, here in Columbus, right, you
it's
see
crazy.
Like a lot of new wings, big buildings in the hospitals. But, you know, John's absolutely right that we have seen a lot of hospitals in rural areas close over the last several years, which means that we have to come up with new ways to make sure that people in rural areas can still have access to care. Telehealth, you know, those types of satellite offices remains a key vital component of our healthcare system. And the final note is, you know, as John noted, there's a lot of hospitals that are operating at near marginal in the red. Mm-hmm. And some of these decisions we've seen, like Medicare for All, will cut reimbursement rates to hospitals, which is one of the reasons people are very concerned about some of the single payer discussions.
Mm, yeah.
And Ann, I think it's important to know, or for people to know and listeners, that the healthcare is changing from you know, some very fundamental elements, a lot of it attributed to new technologies, advances in how healthcare and surgical procedures are administered, and, you know, from inpatient to outpatient services. So, you know, it might not be a hospital. It could be smaller scale type services delivered through other facilities. And so it's, and on top of all the reforms happening at the government side, and with Congress, you know, there's also consumers driving a lot of change in how healthcare is delivered. And we've seen that in recent years, and we're going to continue to see that as hospitals continue to be more focused on population health, addressing health disparities, and meeting those unique needs in the communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this makes me think a little more about the fact that if we did see this, the ACA invalidated in whole, if we lost Medicaid expansion, if we lost these other pieces, the impact on rural areas would be tremendous, because there were so many people that received expansion. There are many healthcare jobs created because now you had paying patients, and it really helped to stabilize some of those rural healthcare facilities.
And yet we still had 3 closed down anyway.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to take one more call. Steve and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ann. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Gosh, where should I start? First of all,
we only have a little bit of time, so
okay. The Affordable Care Act is very unaffordable, and for what you get for a bronze plan, looking at these, you know, $400 a month, and you have to have $10,000 deductible. The whole thing is if it wasn't so sad, it would be silly. But I think the dialogue has to change. The question we need to keep asking is, why do all these developed countries in the world have universal health care except us? We have to keep asking our leaders why we have the money for unlimited war, why we have the money to give billionaires millions of dollars in tax cuts. Why is our priority as a nation war and not taking care of our people? This is the question we have to keep asking our leaders. We can do it, but all we get is excuses why we can't do it. All these other countries can do it. This is what we need to do as a country.
Okay.
And I guess that's the whole issue.
Okay. I mean, thank you, Steve. This is the conversation. I mean, this gets down to how we value all of this. And John Palmer, I know it's complicated, but where do the hospitals shake out when it comes to these kind of fundamental questions about how we view access to healthcare in this country?
I mean, we have to be in the business of perfecting an imperfect law. The ACA brought a lot of new elements with coverage and pre-existing conditions and all that good stuff. But, at the end of the day, it needs to be worked upon and improved upon. And even when Medicaid and Medicare was founded and established, you know, we've been working on making improvements in that area as well. And, you know, when it comes to healthcare, you know, in Ohio, we do have, you know, some health concerns when it comes to smoking, drug deaths, infant mortality, obesity, premature death. And so when you have all those elements happening in a state, and when it comes to delivering health care, these costs and the expenses to meet those needs is where, it really compounds. And so we really have to really, to the gentleman's point, have some discussions about how do we tackle this health care system effectively and making sure that we can get access and coverage to the appropriate areas.
And Ray Hederman?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it as a country, we sat there and we said we want to make sure that people can get access to the best medicine technologies, you know, some of the most up-to-date pharmaceutical drugs. And we really prioritize a lot of innovation, right? And so that's a direction that the administration's looking at, that, you know, we pay more for drugs compared to the rest of the world.
Right.
But part of it is because we as a country subsidize a lot of the pharmaceutical research. And so the idea is, where's the next drug breakthroughs? Where's the next kind of medical miracle is going to come from?
And can we afford it?
Yeah, and can we afford it, right? And that's kind of the debate that we're trying to look at. You know, we spend a lot of money in this country already on healthcare, and I think a lot of the discussions are the value question, right? You know, we spend more than every other country, and we can afford it because we're richer, but are we getting the right value for the payments we're making and delivering the care that we need?
Yeah. Steve Wagner, we're just about to get the last word on this.
Right. I mean, we put all our money in cutting edge. We don't put it in primary care, family practice, rural health, where we're going to really see big changes in making people healthy.
John Palmer, what's next for the Ohio Hospital Association? How do you respond? We've got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, with the Affordable Care Act and the direction it's going, it's something that we continue to work with policymakers on, educating them on the importance of healthcare coverage. But for hospitals, we're not going to slow down on this. We're going to continue to push the envelope and make sure that they're aware of what our concerns are with a repeal without a replacement with this new effort.
Okay, John Palmer, Director of Media and Public Relations for the Ohio Hospital Association. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And also Steve Wagner, Executive Director of Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
And Ray Hederman, Executive Director of the Economic Research Center and Vice President of Policy at the Buckeye Institute. Thanks for your time today.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
And, you know, everybody out there, I say it every time, we'll be back. We'll be talking about this. This is an ongoing story. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.